to Bessner's cabin. Simon, his face flushed and feverish, was propped up with pillows. He looked embarrassed.
"Look, it's awfully good of you to come along, Monsieur Poirot. Look here, there's something I want to ask you."
"Yes?"
Simon got still redder in the face.
It's about Jackie. I want to see her. Do you think... Well, would you mind... Well, would she mind, do you think, if you asked her to come along here? You know, I've been lying here thinking... That wretched kid, well, she is only a kid after all, and I treated her damn badly, and...
He stammered to silence.
Poirot looked at him with interest.
"You desire to see Mademoiselle Jacqueline? I will fetch her."
"Oh, thanks. Awfully good of you."
Poirot went on his quest. He found Jacqueline de Belfort sitting huddled up in a corner of the observation saloon. There was an open book on her lap, but she was not reading. Poirot said gently,
"Will you come with me, Mademoiselle? Monsieur Doyle wants to see you."
She started up, her face flushed, then paled. She looked bewildered.
"Simon? He wants to see me? To see me?"
He found her incredulity moving.
"Will you come, mademoiselle?"
Yes, of course I will."
She went with him in a docile fashion like a child, but like a puzzled child. Poirot passed into the cabin.
"Here is mademoiselle."
She stepped in after him, wavered, stood still, standing there mute and dumb, her eyes fixed on Simon's face. "Hello, Jackie." He too was embarrassed. He went on, "It's awfully good of you to come. I wanted to say, what I mean is..." She interrupted him then. Her words came out in a rush, breathless, desperate.
"Simon, I didn't kill Lynette. You know I didn't do that. I was mad last night. Oh, can you ever forgive me?"
Words came more easily to him now.
"Of course. That's all right. Absolutely all right. Look, that's what I wanted to say. Thought you might be worrying a bit, you know." "Worrying? A bit? Oh, Simon!" "Well, that's what I wanted to see you about. It's quite all right, see, old girl. You just got a bit rattled last night, a shade tight. It's all perfectly natural." "But Simon, I might have killed you."
"Not you. Not with a rotten little pea-shooter like that."
"But, and your leg. Perhaps you'll never walk again."
"Now, look here, Jackie, don't be maudlin. As soon as we get to Assouan, they're going to put the X-rays to work and dig out that tin-pot bullet, and everything will be as right as rain."
Jacqueline gulped twice. Then she rushed forward and knelt down by Simon's bed, burying her face and sobbing. Simon patted her awkwardly on the head. His eyes met Poirot's, and with a reluctant sigh, the latter left the cabin. He heard broken murmurs as he went.
"Oh, how could I be such a devil? Oh, Simon, I'm so dreadfully sorry."
Outside, Cornelia Robson was leaning over the rail. She turned her head.
"Oh, it's you, Monsieur Poirot. It seems so awful somehow that it should be such a lovely day."
Poirot looked up at the sky.
"When the sun shines, you cannot see the moon," he said. "But when the sun is gone, when the sun is gone."
Cornelia's mouth fell open.
"I beg your pardon?"
"I was saying, mademoiselle, that when the sun has gone down, we shall see the moon. That is so, is it not?"
"Why, yes, certainly."
She looked at him doubtfully. Poirot laughed gently.
"I utter the imbecilities," he said. "Take no notice."
He strolled gently towards the stern of the boat. As he passed the next cabin, he paused for a minute. He caught fragments of speech from within.
"Utterly ungrateful. After all I've done for you, no consideration for your wretched mother, no idea of what I suffer."
Poirot's lips stiffened as he pressed them together. He raised a hand and knocked. There was a startled silence, and Mrs. Otterbourne's voice called out.
"Who's that?"
"Is Mademoiselle Rosalie there?"
Rosalie appeared in the doorway. Poirot was shocked at her appearance. There were dark circles under her eyes and drawn lines around her mouth.
"What's the matter?"
she said ungraciously.
"What do you want?"
"The pleasure of a few minutes' conversation with you, mademoiselle. Will you come?"
Her mouth went sulky at once. She shot him a suspicious look.
"Why should I?"
"I entreat you, mademoiselle."
"Oh, I suppose..."
She stepped out on the deck, closing the door behind her. "Well?" Poirot took her gently by the arm and drew her along the deck, still in the direction of the stern. They passed the bathrooms and round the corner. They had the stern part of the deck to themselves. The Nile flowed away behind them. Poirot rested his elbows on the rail. Rosalie stood up straight and stiff.
"Well?"
she said again, and her voice held the same ungracious tone. Poirot spoke slowly, choosing his words.
"I could ask you certain questions, mademoiselle, but I do not think for one moment that you would consent to answer them."
"That seems rather a waste to bring me along here, then."
Poirot drew a finger slowly along the wooden rail.
"You are accustomed, mademoiselle, to carrying your own burdens, but you can do that too long. The strain becomes too great. For you, mademoiselle, the strain is becoming too great."
"I don't know what you're talking about," said Rosalie.
"I am talking about facts, mademoiselle. Plain, ugly facts. Let us call the spade a spade, and say it in one little short sentence. Your mother drinks, mademoiselle."
Rosalie did not answer. Her mouth opened, then she closed it again. For once, she seemed at a loss.
"There is no need for you to talk, mademoiselle. I will do all the talking. I was interested at Assouan in the relations existing between you. I saw at once that in spite of your carefully studied unfilial remarks, you were in reality passionately protecting her from something. I very soon knew what that something was. I knew it long before I encountered your mother one morning in an unmistakable state of intoxication. Moreover, her case, I could see, was one of secret bouts of drinking, by far the most difficult kind of case with which to deal. You were coping with it manfully. Nevertheless, she had all the secret drunkard's cunning. She managed to get hold of a secret supply of spirits and to keep it successfully hidden from you. I should not be surprised if you discovered its hiding place only yesterday. Accordingly, last night, as soon as your mother was really soundly asleep, you stole out with the contents of the cache, went round to the other side of the boat, since your own side was up against the bank, and cast it overboard into the Nile."
He paused.
"I am right, am I not?"
"Yes, you're quite right,"
Rosalie spoke with sudden passion.
"I was a fool not to say so, I suppose, but I didn't want everyone to know. It would go all over the boat, and it seemed so silly. I mean that I..."
Poirot finished the sentence for her.
"So silly that you should be suspected of committing a murder?"
Rosalie nodded. Then she burst out again.
"Oh, I've tried so hard to keep everyone from knowing. It isn't really her fault. She got discouraged. Her books didn't sell any more. People are tired of all that cheap sex stuff. It hurt her. It hurt her dreadfully. And so she began to drink. For a long time I didn't know why she was so queer. Then, when I found out, I tried to stop it. She'd be all right for a bit, and then suddenly she'd start, and there would be dreadful quarrels and rows with people. It was awful."
She shuddered.
"I had always to be on the watch, to get her away. And then, well, she began to dislike me for it. She's turned right against me. I think she almost hates me sometimes."
"Pauvre petite," said Poirot.
She turned on him vehemently.
"Don't be sorry for me. Don't be kind. It's easier if you're not."
She sighed, a long, heart-rending sigh.
"I'm so tired. I'm so deadly, deadly tired."
"I know," said Poirot.
"People think I'm awful, stuck up and cross and bad-tempered. I can't help it. I've forgotten how to be nice."
"That is what I said to you. You have carried your burden by yourself too long."
Rosalie said slowly,
"It is a relief to talk about it. You've always been kind to me, Monsieur Poirot. I'm afraid I've been rude to you often."
"Oh, la politesse, it is not necessary between friends."
The suspicion came back to her face suddenly.
Are you going to tell everyone? I suppose you must because of those damned bottles I threw overboard."
"No. No. It is not necessary. Just tell me what I want to know. At what time was this? 1:10?
About that, I should think. I don't remember exactly."
"Now tell me, mademoiselle, Miss Van Schuyler saw you? Did you see her?"
Rosalie shook her head.
No, I didn't.
She says that she looked out of the door of her cabin.
Well, I don't think I should have seen her. I just looked along the deck and then out to the river.
Poirot nodded.
And did you see anyone at all when you looked down the deck?
There was a pause, quite a long pause. Rosalie was frowning. She seemed to be thinking earnestly. At last, she shook her head quite decisively.
No,
she said.
I saw nobody.
Hercule Poirot slowly nodded his head, but his eyes were grave. Chapter 20 People crept into the dining saloon by ones and twos in a very subdued manner. There seemed a general feeling that to sit down eagerly to food displayed an unfortunate heartlessness. It was with an almost apologetic air that one passenger after another came and sat down at their table. Tim Allerton arrived some few minutes after his mother had taken her seat. He was looking in a thoroughly bad temper. "I wish we'd never come on this blasted trip," he growled. Mrs. Allerton shook her head sadly.
"Oh, my dear, so do I. That beautiful girl. It all seems such a waste to think that anyone could shoot her in cold blood. It seems awful to me that anyone could do such a thing, and that other poor child..."
"Jacqueline?"
"Yes. My heart aches for her. She looks so dreadfully unhappy."
"I'll teach her not to go round loosing off toy firearms," said Tim unfeelingly, as he helped himself to butter.
"I expect she was badly brought up."
"Oh, for God's sake, Mother, don't go all maternal about it."
"You're in a shocking bad temper, Tim."
"Yes, I am. Who wouldn't be?
Well, I don't see what there is to be cross about. It's just frightfully sad."
Tim said crossly, "You're taking the romantic point of view. What you don't seem to realise is that it's no joke being mixed up in a murder case." Mrs. Allerton looked a little startled.
"But surely..."
"No, that's just it. There's no but surely about it. Everyone on this damn boat is under suspicion. You and I, as well as the rest of them."
Mrs. Allerton demurred.
"Well, technically we are, I suppose, but actually it's ridiculous."
"No, there's nothing ridiculous where murder's concerned. You may sit there, darling, just exuding virtue and conscious rectitude, but a lot of unpleasant policemen at Shalal or Aswan won't take you at your face value."
"Well, perhaps the truth will be known before then."
"Why should it be?"
"Well, Monsieur Poirot may find out."
"That old mountebank, he won't find out anything. He's all talk and moustaches."
"Well, Tim," said Mrs. Allerton,
"I dare say everything you say is true. But even if it is, we've got to go through with it. So we might as well make up our minds to it and go through with it as cheerfully as we can."
But her son showed no abatement of gloom.
"Then there's this blasted business of the pearls being missing, too."
"Lynette's pearls?"
"Yes. It seems somebody must have pinched them."
"I suppose that was the motive for the crime," said Mrs. Allerton.
"Why should it be? You're mixing up two perfectly different things."
"Who told you they were missing?"
"Ferguson. He got it from his tough friend in the engine room, who got it from the maid."
"They were lovely pearls,"
said Mrs. Allerton.
Poirot sat down at the table, bowing to Mrs. Allerton.
"I am a little late," he said.
"Well, I expect you've been busy," said Mrs. Allerton.
"Oh, yes, I have been much occupied."
He ordered a fresh bottle of wine from the waiter.
"We are very Catholic in our tastes," said Mrs. Allerton.
"You drink wine always. Tim drinks whiskey and soda, and I, well, try all the different brands of mineral water in turn."
"Tiens,"
said Poirot. He stared at her for a moment.
He murmured to himself,
"It is an idea, that."
And then, with an impatient shrug of the shoulders, he dismissed the sudden preoccupation that had distracted him and began to chat lightly of other matters.
"Is Mr. Doyle badly hurt?"
asked Mrs. Allerton.
Yes, it is a fairly serious injury. Dr. Besnard is anxious to reach Aswan so that his leg can be x-rayed and the bullet removed, but he hopes that there will be no permanent lameness."
"Oh, poor Simon,"
said Mrs. Allerton.
"Only yesterday he looked such a happy boy, with everything in the world he wanted, and now his beautiful wife killed, and he himself laid up and helpless. I do hope, though..."
"What do you hope, madame?"
asked Poirot as Mrs. Allerton paused.
"I hope he's not too angry with that poor child."
"With Mademoiselle Jacqueline? Well, quite the contrary. He was full of anxiety on her behalf."
He turned to Tim.
"You know, it is a pretty little problem of psychology, that. All the time that Mademoiselle Jacqueline was following them from place to place, he was absolutely furious. But now, when she has actually shot him and wounded him dangerously, perhaps made him lame for life, all his anger seems to have evaporated. Can you understand that?"
"Yes," said Tim thoughtfully.
I think I can. The first thing made him feel a fool. Poirot nodded.
You are right. It offended his male dignity.
Yes, but now, if you look at it a certain way, it's she who's made a fool of herself. Everyone's down on her, and so...
He can be generously forgiving, finished Mrs. Allerton. What children men are.
A profoundly untrue statement that women always make, murmured Tim. Poirot smiled. Then he said to Tim,
Tell me, Madame Doyle's cousin, Miss Joanna Southwood, did she resemble Madame Doyle?
You've got it a little wrong, Monsieur Poirot. She was our cousin and Lynette's friend.
Ah, pardon, I was confused. She is a young lady much in the news, that. I have been interested in her for some time.
Why? Asked Tim sharply.
Poirot half rose to bow to Jacqueline de Belfort, who had just come in, and passed their table on the way to her own. Her cheeks were flushed and her eyes bright, and her breath came a little unevenly. As he resumed his seat, Poirot seemed to have forgotten Tim's question. He murmured vaguely,
I wonder if all young ladies with valuable jewels were as careless as Madame Doyle was.
It is true, then, that they were stolen?
Asked Mrs. Allerton.
Who told you so, madame?
Ma Ferguson said so, said Tim. Poirot nodded gravely.
It is quite true.
I suppose, said Mrs. Allerton nervously, that this will mean a lot of unpleasantness for all of us. Tim says it will.
Her son scowled, but Poirot had turned to him.
Ah, you have had previous experience, perhaps? You have been in a house where there was a robbery?
Never, said Tim.
Oh, yes, darling. You were at the Port Arlington's that time, when that awful woman's diamonds were stolen.
Oh, you always get things hopelessly wrong, Mother. I was there when it was discovered that the diamonds she was wearing round her fat neck were only paste. The actual substitution was probably done months earlier. As a matter of fact, a lot of people said she'd done it herself.
Oh, Joanna said so, I expect.
Joanna wasn't there.
No, but she knew them quite well, and it's very like her to make that kind of suggestion.
You're always down on Joanna, Mother. Poirot hastily changed the subject. He had it in mind to make a really big purchase at one of the Aswan shops, some very attractive purple and gold material at one of the Indian merchants. There would, of course, be the duty to pay, but...
They tell me that they can, how do you say, expedite it for me, and that the charges will not be too high. How think you, will it arrive all right?
Mrs. Allerton said that many people, well, so she had heard, had had things sent straight to England from the shops in question, and that everything had arrived safely.
Oh, bien. Then I will do that. But the trouble one has when one is abroad, if a parcel comes out from England. Have you had experience of that? Have you had any parcels arrive since you have been on your travels?
I don't think we have we, Tim? You get books sometimes, but of course there's never any trouble about them.
Ah, no. Books are different.
Dessert had been served. Now, without any previous warning, Colonel Race stood up and made his speech. He touched on the circumstances of the crime and announced the theft of the pearls. A search of the boat was about to be instituted, and he would be obliged if all the passengers would remain in the saloon until this was completed. Then, after that, if the passengers agreed, as he was sure they would, they themselves would be kind enough to submit to a search. Poirot slipped nimbly along to his side. There was a little buzz and hum all around them. Voices, doubtful, indignant, excited. Poirot reached Race's side and murmured something in his ear just as the latter was about to leave the dining saloon. Race listened, nodded assent, and beckoned a steward. He said a few brief words to him, and then, together with Poirot, he passed out onto the deck, closing the door behind him. They stood for a minute or two by the rail. Race lit a cigarette.
Not a bad idea of yours, he said. We'll soon see if there's anything in it. I'll give them 3 minutes.
The door of the dining saloon opened, and the same steward to whom they had spoken came out. He saluted Race and said, Quite right, sir. There's a lady who says it's urgent she should speak to you at once without any delay.
Ah!
Race's face showed his satisfaction.
Who is it?
Miss Bowers, sir, the hospital nurse lady.
A slight shade of surprise showed on Race's face.
He said,
Bring her to the smoking room. Don't let anyone else leave.
No, sir. The other steward will attend to that.
He went back into the dining room. Poirot and Race went to the smoking room.
Bowers, eh?
Murmured Race.
They had hardly got inside the smoking room before the steward reappeared with Miss Bowers. He ushered her in and left, shutting the door behind him.
Well, Miss Bowers?
Colonel Race looked at her inquiringly.
What's all this?
Miss Bowers looked her usual composed, unhurried self. She displayed no particular emotion.
"You'll excuse me, Colonel Race," she said, "but under the circumstances I thought the best thing to do would be to speak to you at once."
She opened her neat black handbag.
"And to return you these."
She took out a string of pearls and laid them on the table. Chapter 21. If Miss Bowers had been the kind of woman who enjoyed creating a sensation, she would have been richly repaid by the result of her action. A look of utter astonishment passed over Colonel Race's face as he picked up the pearls from the table.
"This is most extraordinary," he said. "Will you kindly explain, Miss Bowers?"
"Of course. That's what I've come to do."
Miss Bowers settled herself comfortably in a chair.
"Naturally, it was a little difficult for me to decide what is, or what was, best for me to do. The family would naturally be averse to scandal of any kind, and they trust my discretion. But the circumstances are so very unusual that it really leaves me no choice. Of course, when you didn't find anything in the cabins, your next move would be a search of the passengers. And if the pearls were then found in my possession, it would be rather an awkward situation, and the truth would come out just the same."
"And just what is the truth? Did you take these pearls from Mrs. Doyle's cabin?"
"Oh, no, Colonel Race, of course not. Miss Van Schuyler did."
"Miss Van Schuyler?"
"Yes, she can't help it, you know. But she does take things, especially jewelry. That's really why I'm always with her. It's not her health at all. It's this little idiosyncrasy. I keep on the alert, and fortunately there's never been any trouble since I've been with her. It just means being watchful, you know. And she always hides the things she takes in the same place, rolled up in a pair of stockings. So that makes it very simple. I look each morning. Of course, I'm a light sleeper, and I always sleep next door to her, and with the communicating door open if it's in a hotel, so that I can usually hear. Then I go after her and persuade her to go back to bed. Of course, it's been rather more difficult on a boat, but she doesn't usually do it at night, so it's more just picking up things that she sees left about. Of course, pearls have a great attraction for her, always."
Miss Bowers ceased speaking.
Race asked, "Well, how did you discover they'd been taken?"
"They were in her stockings this morning. I knew whose they were, of course. I've often noticed them. I went along to put them back, hoping that Mrs. Doyle wasn't up yet and hadn't discovered her loss. But there was a steward standing there, and he told me about the murder and that no one could go in. So then, you see, I was in a regular quandary. But I still hoped to slip them back in the cabin later before their absence had been noticed. I can assure you I've passed a very unpleasant morning wondering what was the best thing to do. You see, the Van Schuyler family is so very particular and exclusive. It would never do if this got into the newspapers. But that won't be necessary, will it?"
Miss Bowers looked really worried.
"Now that depends on circumstances," said Colonel Race cautiously. "But we shall do our best for you, of course. What does Miss Van Schuyler say to this?"
"Oh, she'll deny it, of course. She always does. Says some wicked person has put it there. She never admits taking anything. That's why if you catch her in time, she goes back to bed like a lamb. Says she just went out to look at the moon, something like that."
"Does Miss Robson know about this, failing?"
"No, she doesn't. Her mother knows, but she's a very simple kind of girl, and her mother thought it best she should know nothing about it. I was quite equal to dealing with Miss Van Schuyler,"
added the competent Miss Bowers.
"We have to thank you, Mademoiselle, for coming to us so promptly,"
said Poirot. Miss Bowers stood up.
"I'm sure I hope I've acted for the best."
"Be assured that you have."
"You see, what with there being a murder as well—"
Colonel Race interrupted her. His voice was grave.
"Miss Bowers, I'm going to ask you a question, and I want to impress upon you that it has got to be answered truthfully. Miss Van Schuyler is unhinged mentally to the extent of being a kleptomaniac. Has she also a tendency to homicidal mania?"
Miss Bowers' answer came immediately.
"Oh, dear me, no. Nothing of the kind. You can take my word for it, absolutely. The old lady wouldn't hurt a fly."
The reply came with such positive assurance that there seemed nothing more to be said. Nevertheless, Poirot did interpolate one mild inquiry.
"Does Miss Van Schuyler suffer at all from deafness?"
"Well, as a matter of fact, she does, Monsieur Poirot. Not so that you'd notice it anyway, well, not if you were speaking to her, I mean, but quite often she doesn't hear you come into a room, things like that.
Do you think she would have heard anyone moving about in Mrs. Doyle's cabin, which is next door to her own? Oh, I shouldn't think so, not for a minute. You see, the bunk is the other side of the cabin, not even against the partition wall. No, I don't think she would have heard anything. Thank you, Miss Bowers.
Race said,
Well, perhaps you will now go back to the dining saloon and wait for the others.
He opened the door for her and watched her go down the staircase and enter the saloon. Then he shut the door and came back to the table. Poirot had picked up the pearls.
Well,
said Race grimly.
That reaction came pretty quickly. That's a very cool-headed and astute young woman, perfectly capable of holding out on us still further if she thinks it suits her book. Well, what about Miss Van Schuyler now? I don't know we can eliminate her from the possible suspects. You know, she might have committed murder to get hold of those jewels. We can't take the nurse's word for it. She's all out to do the best for the family.
Poirot nodded in agreement. He was very busy with the pearls, running them through his fingers, holding them up to his eyes. He said,
We may take it, I think, that part of the old lady's story to us was true. She did look out of her cabin, and she did see Rosalie Otterbourne. But I don't think she heard anything or anyone in Lynette Doyle's cabin. I think she was just peering out from her cabin, preparatory to slipping along and purloining the pearls.
But the Otterbourne girl was there, then?
Yes. Throwing her mother a secret cache of drink overboard.
Colonel Race shook his head sympathetically.
So that's it. Tough on a young'un.
Yes. Her life has not been very gay, said pauvre petite Rosalie.
Well, I'm glad that's been cleared up. She didn't see or hear anything.
I asked her that. She responded after a lapse of quite 20 seconds, that she saw nobody.
Oh?
Race looked alert.
Yes, it is suggestive that.
Race said slowly,
If Lynette Doyle was shot round about 1:10, or indeed any time after the boat had quieted down, it has seemed amazing to me that no one heard the shot. I grant you that a little pistol like that wouldn't make a noise, but all the same the boat would be deadly quiet, and any noise, even a gentle pop, should have been heard. But I begin to understand better now. The cabin on the forward side of hers was unoccupied, since her husband was in Dr. Bessner's cabin. The one aft was occupied by the Van Schuyler woman who was deaf. That leaves only...
He paused and looked expectantly at Poirot, who nodded.
The cabin next to hers on the other side of the boat. In other words, Pennington. We always seem to come back to Pennington.
Oh, we will come back to him presently with the kid gloves removed. Ah, yes, I am promising myself that pleasure.
In the meantime, we'd better get on with our search of the boat. The pearls still make a convenient excuse, even though they have been returned, but Miss Bowers is not likely to advertise that fact.
Ah, the pearls, yes.
Poirot held them up against the light once more. He stuck out his tongue and licked them. He even gingerly tried one of them between his teeth. Then, with a sigh, he threw them down onto the table.
Here are more complications, my friend, he said. I am not an expert on precious stones, but I have had a good deal to do with them in my time, and I am fairly certain of what I say. These pearls are only a clever imitation.
Chapter 22 Colonel Race swore lustily.
This damned case gets more and more involved.
He picked up the pearls.
I suppose you've not made a mistake. They look all right to me.
Oh, they are a very good imitation, yes.
Now, where does that lead us? I suppose Lynette Doyle didn't deliberately have an imitation made and bring it aboard with her for safety. Well, many women do.
No, I think if that were so, her husband would know about it.
She may not have told him.
Poirot shook his head in a dissatisfied manner.
No, I do not think that is so. I was admiring Mrs. Doyle's pearls the first evening on the boat. Their wonderful sheen and luster. I am sure that she was wearing the genuine ones then.
Well, that brings us up against two possibilities. First, that Miss Van Schuyler only stole the imitation string after the real ones had been stolen by someone else. Second, that the whole kleptomaniac story is a fabrication. Either Miss Bowers is a thief and quickly invented the story and allayed suspicion by handing over the false pearls, or else that whole party is in it together. That's to say, they're a gang of clever jewel thieves masquerading as an exclusive American family.
Yes?
Poirot murmured.
It is difficult to say. But I will point out to you one thing. To make a perfect and exact copy of the purse, clasp and all, good enough to stand the chance of deceiving Mrs. Doyle, is a highly skilled technical performance. It could not be done in a hurry. Whoever copied those pearls must have had a good opportunity of studying the original.
Race rose to his feet.
Well, it's useless to speculate about it any further now. Let's get on with the job. We've got to find the real pearls. And, at the same time, we'll keep our eyes open.
They disposed first of the cabins occupied on the lower deck. That of Signor Ricchetti contained various archaeological works in different languages, a varied assortment of clothing, hair lotions of a highly scented kind, and two personal letters. One from an archaeological expedition in Syria, and one from apparently a sister in Rome. His handkerchiefs were all of coloured silk. They passed on to Ferguson's cabin. There was a sprinkling of communist literature, a good many snapshots, Samuel Butler's Erewhon, and a cheap edition of Pepys' diary. His personal possessions were not many. Most of what outer clothing there was torn and dirty, and the underclothing, on the other hand, was of really good quality. The handkerchiefs were expensive linen ones.
"Some interesting discrepancies," murmured Poirot.
Race nodded.
"Yes, rather odd, but there are absolutely no personal papers, letters, etc."
"Yes, that gives one to think. An odd young man, Monsieur Ferguson."
He looked thoughtfully at a signet ring he held in his hand before replacing it in the drawer where he had found it. They went along to the cabin occupied by Louise Bourget. The maid had her meals after the other passengers, but Race had sent word that she was to be taken to join the others. A cabin steward met them. "Oh, I'm sorry, sir," he apologised, "but I've not been able to find the young woman anywhere. I can't think where she can have got to." Race glanced inside the cabin. It was empty. They went up to the promenade deck and started on the starboard side. The first cabin was that occupied by James Fanthorpe. Here all was in meticulous order. Mr. Fanthorpe travelled light, but all that he had was of good quality.
"No letters," said Poirot thoughtfully. "He is careful, our Monsieur Fanthorpe, to destroy his correspondence."
They passed on to Tim Allerton's cabin next door. There were evidences here of an Anglo-Catholic turn of mind. An exquisite little triptych, and a big rosary of intricately carved wood. Besides personal clothing, there was a half-completed manuscript, a good deal annotated and scribbled over, and a good collection of books, most of them recently published. There were also a quantity of letters thrown carelessly into a drawer. Poirot, never in the least scrupulous about reading other people's correspondence, glanced through them. He noted that amongst them there were no letters from Joanna Southwood. He picked up a tube of secateen, fingered it absently for a minute or two, and then said,
"Let us pass on."
"No Woolworth handkerchiefs," said Race,
rapidly replacing the contents of a drawer. Mrs. Allerton's cabin was the next. It was exquisitely neat, and a faint old-fashioned smell of lavender hung about it. The two men's search was soon over. Race remarked as they left it,
"Nice woman, that."
The next cabin was that which had been used as a dressing room by Simon Doyle. His immediate necessities, pyjamas, toilet things, etc., had been moved to Bessner's cabin, but the remainder of his possessions were still there. Two good-sized leather suitcases and a kit bag. There were also some clothes in the wardrobe.
"We will look carefully here, my friend," said Poirot, "for it is very possible that the thief hid the purse here."
"You think it's likely?"
"Oh, but indeed, yes. Consider. The thief, whoever he or she may be, must know that sooner or later a search will be made, and therefore a hiding place in his or her own cabin would be injudicious in the extreme. The public rooms present other difficulties. But here is a cabin belonging to a man who cannot possibly visit it himself. So that if the pearls are found here, it tells us nothing at all."
But the most meticulous search failed to reveal any trace of the missing necklace. Poirot murmured, "Zut," to himself, and they emerged once more on the deck. Lynette Doyle's cabin had been locked after the body was removed, but Race had the key with him. He unlocked the door, and the two men stepped inside. Except for the removal of the girl's body, the cabin was exactly as it had been that morning.
"Poirot," said Race, "if there's anything to be found here, for God's sake go ahead and find it. You can, if anyone can, I know that."
"This time you do not mean the pearls, mon ami."
"No, the murder's the main thing. There may be something I overlooked this morning."
Quietly, deftly, Poirot went about his search. He went down on his knees and scrutinized the floor, inch by inch. He examined the bed. He went rapidly through the wardrobe and chest of drawers. He went through the wardrobe trunk and the two costly cases. He looked through the expensive gold-fitted dressing case. Finally, he turned his attention to the washstand. There were various creams, powders, face lotions, but the only thing that seemed to interest Poirot were two little bottles labelled Nail-X. He picked them up at last and brought them to the dressing table. One, which bore the inscription Nail-X Rose, was empty, but for a drop or two of dark red fluid at the bottom. The other, the same size, but labelled Nail-X Cardinal, was nearly full. Poirot uncorked first the empty, then the full one, and sniffed them both delicately. An odour of pear drops billowed into the room. With a slight grimace, he recorked them.
"Get anything?"
asked Race. Poirot replied by a French proverb.
"On ne prend pas les mouches avec le vinaigre."
Then he said with a sigh,
"My friend, we have not been fortunate. The murderer has not been obliging. He has not dropped for us the cufflink, the cigarette end, the cigar ash, or in the case of a woman, the handkerchief, the lipstick, or the hair slide. Only a bottle of nail polish."
Poirot shrugged his shoulders.
"Well, I must ask the maid. There is something, yes, a little curious there."
"I wonder where the devil the girl's got to,"
said Race. They left the cabin, locking the door behind them, and passed on to that of Miss Van Schuyler. Here again were all the appurtenances of wealth. Expensive toilet fittings, good luggage, and a certain number of private letters and papers, all perfectly in order. The next cabin was the double one occupied by Poirot, and beyond it that of Race.
"I'll hardly likely to hide him in either of these," said the Colonel.
Poirot demurred.
"It might be. Once on the Orient Express I investigated a murder. There was a little matter of a scarlet kimono. It had disappeared, and yet it must be on the train. I found it, where do you think, eh? In my own locked suitcase. Ah, it was an impertinence, that."
"Well, let's see if anybody has been impertinent with you or me this time."
But the thief of the pearls had not been impertinent with Hercule Poirot or with Colonel Race. Rounding the stern, they made a very careful search of Miss Bowers's cabin, but could find nothing of a suspicious nature. Her handkerchiefs were of plain linen, with an initial. The Otterbourne's cabin came next. Here again, Poirot made a very meticulous search, but with no result. The next cabin was Bessner's. Simon Doyle lay with an untasted tray of food beside him. "Off my feed," he said apologetically. He was looking feverish, and very much worse than earlier in the day. Poirot appreciated Bessner's anxiety to get him as swiftly as possible to hospital and skilled appliances. The little Belgian explained what the two of them were doing, and Simon nodded approval. On learning that the pearls had been restored by Miss Bowers, but proved to be merely imitation, he expressed the most complete astonishment.
"You are quite sure, Monsieur Doyle, that your wife did not have an imitation string which she brought aboard with her instead of the real ones?"
Simon shook his head decisively. "Oh, no. No, I'm quite sure of that. Lynette loved those pearls, and she wore them everywhere. They were insured against every possible risk, so I think that made her a bit careless."
"Then we must continue our search."
He started opening drawers. Race attacked a suitcase. Simon stared. "Look here, you surely don't suspect old Bessner pinched them?" Poirot shrugged his shoulders.
"It might be so. After all, what do we know of Dr. Bessner? Only what he himself gives out."
"Yeah, but he couldn't have hidden them in here without my seeing him."
"He could not have hidden anything today without your having seen him. But we do not know when the substitution took place. He may have affected the exchange some days ago."
"Well, I never thought of that." But the search was unavailing. The next cabin was Pennington's. The two men spent some time in their search. In particular, Poirot and Race examined carefully a case of legal and business documents, most of them requiring Lynette's signature. He shook his head gloomily.
"These seem all square and above board, you agree?"
"Oh, absolutely. Still, the man isn't a born fool. If there had been a compromising document here, a power of attorney or something of that kind, he'd be pretty sure to have destroyed it first thing."
"Now that he's so, yes."
Poirot lifted a heavy Colt revolver out of the top drawer of the chest of drawers, looked at it and put it back.
"So it seems there are still some people who travel with revolvers," he murmured.
"Yes, a little suggestive, perhaps. Still, Lynette Doyle wasn't shot with a thing that size."
Race paused and then said,
"You know, I've thought of a possible answer to your point about the pistol being thrown overboard. Supposing that the actual murderer did leave it in Lynette Doyle's cabin, and that someone else, some second person, took it away and threw it into the river."
Yes, that is possible. I have thought of it, but it opens up a whole string of questions. Who was that second person? What interest had they in endeavouring to shield Jacqueline de Belfort by taking away the pistol? What was that second person doing there? The only other person we know of who went into the cabin was Miss Van Schuyler. Was it conceivably Miss Van Schuyler who removed it? Why should she wish to shield Jacqueline de Belfort? And yet, what other reason can there be for the removal of the pistol?
Race suggested,
well, she may have recognized the stole as hers, got the wind up and thrown the whole bag of tricks over on that account.
The stole, perhaps. But would she have got rid of the pistol, too?
Still, I agree that it is a possible solution. But it is clumsy. Bon Dieu, it is clumsy. And you still have not appreciated one point about the stole.
As they emerged from Pennington's cabin, Poirot suggested that Race should search the remaining cabins, those occupied by Jacqueline, Cornelia, and two empty ones at the end, while he himself had a few words with Simon Doyle. Accordingly, he retraced his steps along the deck and re-entered Bessner's cabin. Simon said,
"Look here, I've been thinking. I'm perfectly sure that these pearls were all right yesterday."
"Why is that, Monsieur Doyle?"
"Because Lynette," he winced as he uttered his wife's name, "was passing them through her hands just before dinner and talking about them. She knew something about pearls. I feel she'd have known if they were a fake."
"Well, they were a very good imitation, though. Tell me, was Mrs. Doyle in the habit of letting those pearls out of her hands? Did she ever lend them to a friend, for instance?"
Simon flushed with slight embarrassment. "You see, Monsieur Poirot, it's difficult for me to say. I hadn't known Lynette very long."
"Ah, no. It was a quick romance, yours."
Simon went on. "And so really I shouldn't know a thing like that, but Lynette was awfully generous with her things. I should think she might have done."
"She never, for instance..."
Poirot's voice was very smooth.
"She never, for instance, lent them to Mademoiselle de Belfort?"
"Oh, what do you mean?" Simon flushed brick red, tried to sit up, and wincing, fell back. "What are you getting at? That Jackie stole the pearls? Well, she didn't. I'll swear she didn't. Jackie's as straight as a die. The mere idea of her being a thief is ridiculous, absolutely ridiculous." Poirot looked at him with gently twinkling eyes.
"Oh, la la la,"
he said unexpectedly.
"The suggestion of mine, it has indeed stirred up the nest of hornets."
Simon repeated doggedly, unmoved by Poirot's lighter note,
"Jackie's straight."
Poirot remembered a girl's voice by the Nile in Aswan saying,
"I love Simon, and he loves me."
He had wondered which of the three statements he had heard that night was the true one. It seemed to him that it had turned out to be Jacqueline who had come closest to the truth. The door opened and Race came in.
"Nothing,"
he said briskly.
"Well, we didn't expect it. I see the stewards coming along with their report as to the searching of the passengers."
A steward and stewardess appeared in the doorway. The former spoke first.
"Nothing, sir."
"Any of the gentlemen make any fuss?"
"Only the Italian gentleman, sir. He carried on a good deal, said it was a dishonour, something of that kind. He got a gun on him, too."
"What kind of gun?"
"A Mauser, automatic, .25, sir."
"Italians are pretty hot-tempered," said Simon. "Ricchetti got in no end of a stew at Wadi Halfa just because of a mistake over a telegram. He was darned rude to Lynette over it." Race turned towards the stewardess. She was a big, handsome-looking woman.
"Nothing on any of the ladies, sir. They made a good deal of fuss, except for Mrs. Allerton, who was as nice as a lady could be. But no sign of pearls. By the way, the young lady, Miss Rosalie Otterbourne, had a little pistol in her handbag." "What kind?" "It was a very small one, sir, with a pearl handle, a kind of toy."
Race stared.
"Devil take this case," he muttered. "I thought we got her cleared of suspicion, and now, oh, does every girl on this blinking boat carry around pearl-handled toy pistols?"
He shot a question at the stewardess.
"Did she show any feeling over your finding it?"
The woman shook her head.
"I don't think she noticed. I had my back turned whilst I was going through the handbags." "Still, she must have known you'd come across it. Oh, well, it beats me. What about the maid?"
"Well, we've looked all over the boat, sir. We can't find her anywhere."
"Well, what's this?" asked Simon.
"Mrs. Doyle's maid, Louise Bourget. She's disappeared."
"Disappeared?" Race said thoughtfully.
"She might have stolen the pearls. She's the one person who had ample opportunity to get a replica made.
And then, when she found a search was being instituted, she threw herself overboard? Suggested Simon.
No nonsense, said Race irritably. A woman can't throw herself overboard in broad daylight from a boat like this without somebody realizing the fact. There, she's bound to be somewhere on board.
He addressed the stewardess once more.
When was she last seen?
About half an hour before the bell went for lunch, sir.
Now we'll have a look at her cabin anyway, said Race. That may tell us something.
He led the way to the deck below. Poirot followed him. They unlocked the door of the cabin and passed inside. Louise Bourget, whose trade it was to keep other people's belongings in order, had taken a holiday where her own were concerned. Odds and ends littered the top of the chest of drawers. A suitcase gaped open with clothes hanging out of the side of it and preventing its shutting. Underclothing hung limply over the sides of the chairs. As Poirot, with swift, neat fingers, opened the drawers of the dressing chest, Race examined the suitcase. Louise's shoes were lined along by the bed. One of them, a black patent leather, seemed to be resting at an extraordinary angle, almost unsupported. The appearance of it was so odd that it attracted Race's attention. He closed the suitcase and bent over the line of shoes. Then he uttered a sharp exclamation. Poirot whirled round.
Qu'est-ce qu'il y a?
Race said grimly.
She hasn't disappeared. She's here, under the bed.
Chapter 23 The body of a dead woman who in life had been Louise Bourget lay on the floor of her cabin. The two men bent over it. Race straightened himself first.
Been dead close on an hour, I should say. We'll get Bessner onto it. Stabbed to the heart. Death pretty well instantaneous, I should imagine. She doesn't look pretty, does she?
No.
Poirot shook his head with a slight shudder. The dark feline face was convulsed as though with surprise and fury, the lips drawn back from the teeth. Poirot bent again gently and picked up the right hand. Something just showed within the fingers. He detached it and held it out to Race. A little sliver of flimsy paper coloured a pale mauvish pink.
You see what it is? Money, said Race. The corner of a 1,000-franc note, I fancy. Well, it's clear what happened, said Race. She knew something, and she was blackmailing the murderer with her knowledge. We thought she wasn't being quite straight this morning.
Poirot cried out.
We have been idiots, fools. We should have known. Then, what did she say? What could I have seen or heard? I was on the deck below. Naturally, if I had been unable to sleep, if I had mounted the stairs, then perhaps I might have seen this assassin, this monster, enter or leave Madame's cabin. But as it is... Of course, that is what did happen. She did come up. She did see someone going into Lynette Doyle's cabin or coming out of it. And because of her greed, her insensate greed, she lies here. And we're no nearer to knowing who killed her.
Finished Race disgustedly. Poirot shook his head.
No, no. We know much more now. We know almost everything. Only what we know seems incredible, yet it must be so. Only I do not see. What a fool I was this morning. We felt, both of us felt, that she was keeping something back, and yet we never realized the logical reason. Blackmail. Well, she must have demanded hush money straight away, said Race. Demanded it with threats. The murderer was forced to accede to that request and paid her in French notes. Anything there?
Poirot shook his head thoughtfully.
No, I hardly think so. Many people take a reserve of money with them when travelling, sometimes £5 notes, sometimes dollars, but very often French notes as well. Possibly the murderer paid her all he had in a mixture of currencies. Let us continue our reconstruction. The murderer comes to her cabin, gives her the money, And then, said Poirot, she counts it. Ah, yes, I know that class. She would count the money, and while she counted it, she was completely off her guard. The murderer struck. Having done so successfully, he gathered up the money and fled, not noticing that the corner of one of the notes was torn. Well, we may get him that way, said Race doubtfully. I doubt it, said Poirot. He will examine those notes, and will probably notice the tear. Of course, if he was of a parsimonious disposition, he would not be able to bring himself to destroy a mille note.
But I very much fear that his temperament is just the opposite. But how do you make that out? Both this crime and the murder of Mrs. Doyle demanded certain qualities. Courage, audacity, bold execution, lightning action. Those qualities do not accord with a saving, prudent disposition.
Race shook his head sadly.
I'd better get Bessner down, he said.
The Stout's doctor examination did not take long. Accompanied by a good many achs and sos, he went to work.
She has been dead not more than an hour, he announced. Death was very quick, at once. And what weapon do you think was used?
Oh, it is interesting, but it was something very sharp, very thin, very delicate. I could show you the kind of thing.
Back again in his cabin, he opened a case and extracted a long, delicate surgical knife.
It was something like that, my friend. It was not a common table knife. I suppose, said Race smoothly, that none of your own knives are missing, Doctor.
Bessner stared at him. Then his face grew red with indignation.
What is that you say? Do you think I, Karl Bessner, who so well known is all over Austria, I with my clinics, my highly born patients, I have killed a miserable little femme de chambre? But it is ridiculous, absurd, what you say. None of my knives are missing, not one. I tell you, they are all here, correct, in their places. You can see for yourself, and this insult to my profession I will not forget.
Dr. Bessner closed his case with a snap, flung it down, and stamped out onto the deck. Phew, said Simon. You've put the old boys back up. Poirot shrugged his shoulders.
It is regrettable.
You're on the wrong tack. Old Bessner's one of the best, even though he's a kind of bosh. Dr. Bessner reappeared suddenly.
Will you be so kind as to leave me now, my cabin? I have to do the dressing of my patient's leg.
Miss Bowers had entered with him and stood brisk and professional, waiting for the others to go. Race and Poirot crept out meekly. Race muttered something and went off. Poirot turned to his left. He heard scraps of girlish conversation, a little laugh. Jacqueline and Rosalie were together in the latter's cabin. The door was open and the two girls were standing near it. As his shadow fell on them, they looked up. He saw Rosalie Otterbourne smile at him for the first time, a shy, welcoming smile, a little uncertain in its lines, as of one who does a new and unfamiliar thing.
Ah, you talk the scandal, mademoiselles, huh?
He accused them.
No, indeed, said Rosalie. As a matter of fact, we were just comparing lipsticks.
Poirot smiled.
Ah, les chiffons d'aujourd'hui,
he murmured. But there was something a little mechanical about his smile, and Jacqueline de Belfort, quicker and more observant than Rosalie, saw it. She dropped the lipstick she was holding and came out upon the deck.
What has happened now?
It is as you guess, mademoiselle, something has happened.
What?
Rosalie came out too.
Another death,
said Poirot. Rosalie caught her breath sharply. Poirot was watching her narrowly. He saw alarm and something more. Consternation. Show for a minute or two in her eyes.
Mrs. Doyle's maid has been killed, he said bluntly.
Killed? Cried Jacqueline. Killed, do you say?
Yes, that is what I said.
Though his answer was nominally to her, it was Rosalie whom he watched. It was Rosalie to whom he spoke as he went on.
You see, this maid, she saw something she was not intended to see. And so, she was silenced in case she should not hold her tongue.
What was it she saw?
Again, it was Jacqueline who asked, and again Poirot's answer was to Rosalie. It was an odd little three-cornered scene.
There is, I think, very little doubt what it was she saw, said Poirot. She saw someone enter and leave Lynette Doyle's cabin on that fatal night.
His ears were quick. He heard the sharp intake of breath and saw the eyelids flicker. Rosalie Otterbourne had reacted just as he had intended she should.
Did she say who it was she saw?
Rosalie asked. Gently, regretfully, Poirot shook his head. Footsteps pattered up the deck. It was Cornelia Robson, her eyes wide and startled.
"Oh, Jacqueline," she cried, "something awful has happened, another dreadful thing."
Jacqueline turned to her. The two moved a few steps forward. Almost unconsciously, Poirot and Rosalie Otterbourne moved in the other direction. Rosalie said sharply,
"Why do you look at me? What have you got in your mind?"
"That is two questions you ask me. I will ask you only one in return. Why do you not tell me all the truth, mademoiselle?"
I don't know what you mean. I told you everything this morning.
No. There were things you did not tell me. You did not tell me that you carry about in your handbag a small caliber pistol with a pearl handle. You did not tell me all that you saw last night.
She flushed. Then she said sharply, "It's quite untrue. I haven't got a revolver."
"I did not say a revolver. I said a small pistol that you carry about in your handbag."
She wheeled round, darted into her cabin, and out again, and thrust her grey leather handbag into his hands.
"You're talking nonsense. Look for yourself if you like."
Poirot opened the bag. There was no pistol inside. He handed the bag back to her, meeting her scornful, triumphant glance.
"No," he said pleasantly, "it is not there."
"You see, you're not always right, Monsieur Poirot. And you're wrong about that other ridiculous thing you said."
"No, no, no, I do not think so."
"Oh, you're infuriating!" She stamped an angry foot. "You get an idea into your head, and you go on and on and on about it."
"Because I want you to tell me the truth."
"What is the truth? You seem to know it better than I do," Poirot said.
"You want me to tell you what it was you saw? If I am right, will you admit that I am right? I will tell you my little idea. I think that when you came around the stern of the boat, you stopped involuntarily because you saw a man come out of a cabin about halfway down the deck. Lynette Doyle's cabin, as you realized next day. You saw him come out, close the door behind him, and walk away from you down the deck and perhaps enter one of the two end cabins. Now then, am I right, mademoiselle?"
She did not answer.
Poirot said, "Perhaps you think it wiser not to speak. Perhaps you are afraid that if you do, you too will be killed."
For a moment, he thought she had risen to the easy bait, that the accusation against her courage would succeed where more subtle arguments would have failed. Her lips opened, trembled, and then,
"I saw no one,"
said Rosalie Otterbourne. Chapter 24 Miss Bowers came out of Dr. Bessner's cabin, smoothing her cuffs over her wrists. Jacqueline left Cornelia abruptly and accosted the hospital nurse. "How is he?" she demanded. Poirot came up in time to hear the answer. Miss Bowers was looking rather worried. "Things aren't going too badly," she said. Jacqueline cried, "You mean he's worse?" "Well, I must say I shall be relieved when we get in and can get a proper X-ray done and the whole thing cleaned up under an anaesthetic. When do you think we shall get to Shillelagh, Monsieur Poirot?"
"Tomorrow morning."
Miss Bowers pursed her lips and shook her head.
"It's very unfortunate. We're doing all we can, but there's always such a danger of septicemia."
Jacqueline caught Miss Bowers' arm and shook it.
"Is he going to die? Is he going to die?" "Oh, dear me, no, Mr. Belfort. That is, I hope not, I'm sure. The wound in itself isn't dangerous, but there's no doubt it ought to be X-rayed as soon as possible. And then, of course, poor Mr. Doyle ought to have been kept absolutely quiet today. He's had far too much worry and excitement. No wonder his temperature is rising, what with the shock of his wife's death and one thing and another."
Jacqueline relinquished her grasp of the nurse's arm and turned away. She stood leaning over the side, her back to the other two.
"What I say is, we've got to hope for the best always," said Miss Bowers. "Of course, Mr. Doyle has a very strong constitution, one can see that, probably never had a day's illness in his life, so that's in his favour. But there's no denying that his rise in temperature is a nasty sign, and..." Oh.
She shook her head, adjusted her cuffs once more, and moved briskly away. Jacqueline turned and walked gropingly, blinded by tears, towards her cabin. A hand below her elbow steadied and guided her. She looked up through the tears to find Poirot by her side. She leaned on him a little, and he guided her through the cabin door. She sank down on the bed, and the tears came more freely, punctuated by great shuddering sobs.
"He'll die. He'll die. I know he'll die. And I shall have killed him, yes. I shall have killed him."
Poirot shrugged his shoulders. He shook his head a little sadly.
"Mademoiselle, what is done. One cannot take back the accomplished action. It is too late to regret."
She cried out even more vehemently,
"But I shall have killed him, and I love him so, I love him so."
Poirot sighed.
"Too much."
It had been his thought long ago in the restaurant of Monsieur Blondin. It was his thought again now. He said, hesitating a little,
Do not at all events go by what Miss Bowers says. Hospital nurses, me, I find them always gloomy. The night nurse, always, she is astonished to find her patient alive in the evening. The day nurse, always, she is surprised to find him alive in the morning. They'd know too much, you see, of the possibility.